I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, represented by CBS News Radio. And it's a great pleasure to welcome my longtime colleague, friend, and informant of matters to do with the United States Navy, Captain Jerry Hendricks, U.S. Navy aviator retired, who is the author of a new book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, subtitle, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry, congratulations for the book. And we begin with our conversation with threat. You have asked, and the 65th Secretary of the Navy, John Layman, has generously remarked upon your book as a foreword. And in it, Mr. Layman uses this historical analogy to explain the present challenge for the U.S. Navy to do with the Pacific Ocean. He says that it is wise to think of the Western Pacific, that would be East Asia, that would be the People's Republic of China, the Western Pacific as the inner German border, referring to the 20th century. What does that mean, Jerry? How does that explain the threat and the challenge for the U.S. Navy in the 21st century? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, and thank you again for having me on. It's great to join you in your new venue here. I think what Secretary Layman is talking about there is he contextualizes within his, as you said, very, very kind foreword to the book, is he's talking both strategically and geographically. So the inner German border during the Cold War was where the battle of ideas in so many ways was being played out. And we can remember the idea of the Berlin Wall, and we can also remember the fixation with the Fulda Gap as an area of high vulnerability for the Western alliance against the Warsaw Pact nations. That was where the competition would be played out if it went to war, but it was also where the competition was being played out in the Cold War peacetime environment in sort of an arena of ideas, the idea of Western democracies and capitalism going up against the Eastern communist countries and their particular form of economic coercion. And so when we pivot and we look at our current competition, specifically vis-a-vis China, then the Western Pacific becomes the place where those battle of ideas, the idea of the centrally controlled economy, the idea of the central authoritarian state, which the Chinese are promoting, both within their own country as well as trying to get the subservience of all the other nations, the Western Pacific, to bow to them and their wishes. But it also would be the location of where a war would play out if it went to that place. So wars are determined in so many ways by both the capabilities and capacity of the opposing sides, but wars are also dependent upon the geography. And so the Western Pacific has some very specific geography that will funnel and create points of conflict that we can sort of recognize and anticipate. So I think Secretary Layman has correctly identified that the Western Pacific is the area of competition for the future, and he is right to put our lens upon that.
A civilian such as myself might think to this problem, hey, it's the ocean. Anybody can go there. You can't stop it. There are no walls, and the weather comes and the weather goes, and if you're floating across a vast expanse, who's going to stop you, and who's going to dominate that vast expanse? As Marcus Aurelius taught us, you can't put your foot in the same river twice. Same for the ocean. However, what I learned from Jerry's book is that the presumed open ocean is a construction of the Enlightenment. It wasn't always this way. The Romans dominated the Middle Sea 2,000 years ago. But let's speak to the conflict that Jerry identifies, because his book is part historical background and part projection of what is needed into the future. We go to the early 17th century, an incident between the Portuguese and the ambition of the Dutch. What happened, Jerry, and what did we learn from that? What did a philosopher named Grotius learn from that?
Well, it's a great place to start, because what happens in this conversation, this intellectual conversation, then goes on to inform the very basic foundational concepts of the Enlightenment, which in turn, you know, formed the United States and most of the Western world today. But to flashback, there was a point in time when the oceans were divided by papal decree between Portugal and Spain. And so one portion of the world was ruled by Portugal, had been deeded to it virtually by treaty, and the other part was retained to Spain. That, of course, would not stand as the Protestant republics rose, and the Dutch and the British came to the fore and began their own areas of exploration and commercial development. They began to sail on, quote, Portuguese and Spanish seas. And so this became an area of legal contention. There was a point in time when a Dutch ship seized a Portuguese ship that was operating ostensibly in Portuguese waters, at least as defined by the church. And so the Dutch seized the goods of this ship. The goods were quite valuable. In fact, it was essentially worth the value of the cost to run a government, the Dutch government at least, for a year. But then the Portuguese sued them in court. And Hugo Grotius was hired by the Dutch East India Company to essentially defend their claim. And Grotius does a wonderful thing, which is he actually loses the case for his client. The Dutch actually have to return the value of the goods to the Portuguese. But what he does is he makes an argument for what he terms as the free sea, which is that there is nothing in natural law, which is to say the law of nature as observed by man that we ascribe to God. And he says that there is nothing that stops the flow of a movement of a ship as it moves through the winds and the currents, you know, across the ocean. And so there's not even a natural barrier like a mountain range or a river that you would have on land. And so he comes up with this construct of the free sea. And he says that that which cannot be abridged by God cannot be abridged by man. And so this idea of the right of a free sea to have free trade unencumbered across the oceans is essentially comes down in this legal decision, which Grotius calls mare clausum. I'm sorry, mare librum, which is the open or free sea. There's a countering school called mare clausum, which is that there is a closed sea, but that argument loses. And so the free sea becomes foundational then to just a few decades later to the idea of individual liberty and individual freedom. So as things can flow evenly or across the ocean, then mankind can flow, and the idea of the individual movement across, so long as it doesn't impinge upon others, their rights or their desires, then no individual should be, their movement should not be abridged. And so this concept of freedom sort of grows out of it and informs the way that we view the world today, at least in the terms of the Western Enlightenment. And so this coming to this understanding of the free sea is very critical to understanding what it is that we, in the United States and the Western world today, have built over the last 70 years. Because the fact is that for much of the last four centuries, since Grotius came down with this idea in 1609, the seas were not free. There was piracy, there was navies that were claiming vast portions of the sea, and there was many, many battles fought over these ideas. But slowly but surely, these ideas became cemented into essentially the Western canon. Now, really, really comes to culmination is after 1945 and the Great War in the Pacific and in the Atlantic, where finally the United States and its allies emerge very much triumphant. So triumphant that the U.S. has 6,000 ships and the British have some 1,800 ships, and there's virtually no other competitors on the world's oceans. And so in that environment, the number of battles goes to zero, virtually. There's been less than 30 battles over the last 70 years, but it's the ideas that prevail, and the idea of free and unencumbered trade back and forth across the world has had a dramatic effect upon the lives of man worldwide, as we see just a dramatic uptick in global economic production and a dramatic decrease in things like extreme poverty and even illiteracy. So post-1945 is a world that's been created by the free sea, in which the United States has sort of really labored over the last 70 years to build and then defend.
I'm speaking with Captain Jerry Hendricks, United States Navy aviator retired. His new book, To Provide and Maintain a Navy, Why Naval Primacy is America's First Best Strategy. Jerry's just taken us on a tour of 400 years. When we come back, lessons learned in those 400 years that apply today to the contest between the United States Navy and the PLA, the People's Liberation Army Navy, in the Western Pacific. That's the geostrategic area that is in question here, the Western Pacific, the first string of islands, the second string of islands, all the way out to the third string of islands. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, represented by CBS Radio News.